Chapter 20. Fikrit Shotman. Sunday, the 8th of January, 1939. The telegram authorizing your servitor, Zek SH744239, to return to Moscow from Second River Transit Camp, where I washed up after my sentence ended, specified first available transport, which happened to be one of those old first-class coaches from before the revolution. Which is how I came to journey west in a Trans-Siberian passenger carriage, filled with Red Army officers going home on furlough. The benches were fitted with cushions, something that would have tickled my camp wife, Magda, if she'd been with me, which, sorry to say, she wasn't. She still had 5 years to serve when she waved goodbye to me as my motor barge pulled away from the Kolmar pier. I didn't take it badly, she was sizing up the new batch of prisoners on the hillside. In her shoes, I would do the same. The train back took 3 hours short of 3 days to reach Moscow, which was a big improvement on my 19 days in a cattle car going out. Being as my travelling companions were officers, a field kitchen had been set up in another wagon and mess sergeants distributed warm food, on china plates no less, twice a day. Me being the only civilian in the coach, the officers took me for an important checkist, and treated me with high regard. I let them think I was as important as they thought I was. Two Czechists in uniform, one a full colonel, were waiting for me on the quay when my train pulled into Moscow. Shotman, Fikrit? The colonel asked, looking up at me because I towered over him. One and the same, I said. Here's what took place next. The colonel whipped a paw up to his visor and snapped off a smarter salute as you're going to see in Soviet Russia. It actually flashed through my thick skull that he was saluting someone behind me, but there was nobody behind me close enough to get saluted. Not wanting to appear bad-mannered, I saluted back. We have a car waiting, the colonel announced, treating me, like the officers in the first-class railway coach, with high regard. So he wouldn't think I was bowled over by all this attention. I shrugged indifferently and trailed after him through the flood of passengers out the station's enormous entrance hall. Sure enough, an Uzbek corporal was standing to attention next to the open door of a shiny blue American Packard. I squeezed into the back, my knees cramped up to my chin. When I rolled down the window to get some air, Moscow winters are summers compared to Siberian winters. I saw the glass was as thick as my little finger. I supposed this was how Americans made cars, though I couldn't think what advantage thick glass would have over thin. To my surprise, four militiamen on motorcycles leapfrogged ahead of the Packard, blocking cross-traffic at intersections so we could run red lights. I got a laugh watching people peering into the car to catch sight of the important apparatchik who could make traffic stop for him. After some minutes, I spotted the Kremlin wall ahead at the foot of the street named after the late Maxim Gorky. It sticks in my head he had something to do with books. I remembered Magda reading aloud his death notice in the Kolmar Weekly newsletter maybe 2 years back, which is how come I knew he was late. When we reached the wall, with Glorious Red Square off on the left, the Packard went to the right, then turned left across a small bridge and drove through a Kremlin gate I happened to know was not open to the public. All the time I kept asking myself where I was being taken, and why. Inside the Kremlin compound, the car pulled up in front of a low brick building. The Uzbek sprang from his seat to open the back door of the automobile. Sunlight was shining off the onion dome of a church, and I had to shield my eyes with a hand to see. The colonel must have thought I was saluting him because he saluted me again. Darting ahead of me, the Uzbek pulled open the front door of the building. Comrade Stalin's chief bodyguard, the one who frisked me the time I shook Stalin's hand in 1932, I remembered him because he was almost as big as me. His name escapes me. With any luck, it'll come back before you finish recording my answers to your questions, was waiting in the vestibule. Only this time he didn't frisk me. He jerked his head for me to follow him down a flight of stairs. We came to a glass door with writing on it, and he jerked his head again for me to go inside, which I did. In 1,000 years, you'll never guess where I was. I was in a tailor shop, yes, a genuine tailor shop with four men slumped over Singer sewing machines. I know the brand because we had the same ones at the circus to repair costumes, their feet furiously working the pedals. Hanging off hangers along one wall was more suits than you could count. Piles of folded shirts and shoes filled cubbyholes along another wall. An Israelite tailor, a stooped man with curly hair, began measuring me with the cloth tape measure draped over his neck. Mumbling to himself, the Israelite pulled a dark blue suit off a hanger. "We will have to let out the sleeves and the trousers," he told the bodyguard. "How long will it take?"
20 minutes.
"Do it in 10. The tailor gave the trousers to one of his sewers and the jacket to another, and they dropped what they were doing and went to work. While they were lengthening the sleeves and trousers, I was ordered to strip to my underwear. I was given a white shirt with a collar attached and genuine leather lace-up shoes that came to a point in front and pinched my toes. When the sewers finished sewing, they ironed the new cuffs and sleeves with an iron that looked to be attached by a cord to an electricity outlet. What will they invent next? I tried on the suit and buttoned the double-breast jacket and took a look at myself in the full-length mirror. If Magda could see me, she would have thought she was high on chafir. The Israelite offered me a choice of neckties, but not knowing how to tie one, I waved him off and buttoned a shirt up to my neck, Azerbaijani style. My old clothes, the canvas trousers and the flannel shirt that had belonged to Magda's suicided camp husband, the felt boots with the worn-down cork soles, were thrown into a carton on the floor. When I asked if I could have them back, the bodyguard laughed. The Israelites at the sewing machines began laughing too. Not wanting to be left out of the joke, I laughed along with them. With my new shoe squeaking under my weight and the collar of the starched shirt scratching at my neck, I followed the bodyguard down a long underground passage lighted every few meters by overhead bulbs. I knew electricity didn't grow on trees. I wondered if they turned the bulbs off at night to save money. At the end of the passageway, we climbed a spiral staircase to a locked door 3 flights up. The bodyguard, his name just now came to me. It's Vlasic. Agrippina used to say brains were not my strong suit, but I'm not doing too bad, am I? This Vlasic took out a ring of keys and fitted one of them into the lock, and the door, which turned out to be made of iron, clicked open. I followed him up another flight of stairs and down a hallway into a room with polished benches along the walls. Behind a desk with 3 telephones on it sat a hairless man with acne. On the wall behind him there was an inspirational picture of Comrade Lenin, his right hand cutting the air, speaking to a crowd of workers from a wooden platform. Comrade Stalin's bodyguard said, "He's here." The hairless man at the desk picked up one of the telephones and said, "He's here." He looked up. "Take him straight in." I caught my breath as I walked through the door. It was the very same room where Comrade Stalin shook my hand when I won silver in Vienna, Austria. A short man wearing a military tunic was standing at one of the windows, looking out at the Kremlin church with the sun shining off the dome. Vlasic coughed into his fist. The person at the window turned slowly to face me. It was Comrade Stalin in the flesh, smaller and older and tireder than I remembered from when I met him 6 years before. He hitched up his trousers and, making his way around the desk, stuck out a soft hand. "Stalin," he said. I shook his hand, being careful not to squeeze it. "Shotman, Fikrit," I managed to say, though I was short of breath from breathing the same air as the person I admired most in the world. Comrade Stalin took a cigarette with a long cardboard tip from a silver case and offered it to me. "I used to smoke hand-rolled makhorka," I said, "but I gave it up, Excellency." "I wish I didn't smoke," he said, holding the flame from a small lighter to the end of the cigarette. He expelled a lungful of smoke. "I intend to give up cigarettes the day America goes communist." He went around the desk and sat down on an ordinary chair and pointed to another chair on my side of the desk. I must have looked at it uncertainly because Vlasic growled at me, "Sit for God's sake." I did. Comrade Stalin said, "I remember you very well, Shotman. People your size are not easily forgotten. You were the champion weightlifter with the bad knee. When the Kremlin doctors screwed up the operation, Khrushchev had the bright idea of turning you into a circus strongman. How has life treated you since?
I was thrilled that Comrade Stalin, with the weight of the Soviet state on his shoulders, not to mention the world communist movement, remembered someone as not important as Fikrit Shotman. Naturally, I told him the truth. I was accused of being Wrecker, for having a sticker of the Eiffel Tower on my steamer trunk, for having Tsarist state loan coupons in its drawers. I served 4 years mining gold on the Kolma River.
I know about Siberia, Comrade Stalin said. To speak plainly, that's why you're here.
He picked through a pile of what looked like telegrams.
The commandant at Second River reports that you came across the poet Mandelstam while you were waiting for transportation west after finishing your sentence.
Am I in trouble because of Mandelstam? I blurted out.
Only answer Comrade Stalin's questions honestly and all will go well for you, Vlasic said from the wall.
You are not in trouble, Comrade Stalin assured me. Take your time. Tell me what you know of this Mandelstam.
When I reached Second River, around the middle of October, it was crawling with prisoners. There was no free bunks left in the barracks, so I camped out under tent canvas rigged between two barracks. I'm not complaining, only giving you information, Excellency. One of the first things I saw was naked men sitting on the ground in front of the latrines, searching their clothes and each other's scalps for lice, and crushing them between their fingers when they found them. I recognized one of the prisoners. It was Mandelstam.
How could you recognize him? Had you met him before?
I shared a cell with him in 1934 when I was being interrogated in the Lubyanka.
Huh. So that's the connection.
Comrade Stalin sucked on his cigarette, slapping away the smoke with a palm so he could keep an eye on me.
What was Mandelstam like when you met him in the Lubyanka?
To tell the truth, Excellency, he was a bit loony at times. He thought he could walk through walls. He boasted about meeting you in the Kremlin. He described going down a hallway filled with paintings of Russian generals. He was very mysterious. He said it would be dangerous for me to know what you talked about. At the end, he would have cut his wrist with a piece of broken china bowl if I hadn't stopped him. I could make out Comrade Stalin scowling. Then he said something I still don't comprehend.
I never met Mandelstam in the Kremlin. I never met him outside the Kremlin, for that matter.
I never bought his story about meeting you, I said quickly, which wasn't the honest-to-God truth. Osip Emilievich described the meeting with Comrade Stalin in so much detail, it never entered my head he was making it up.
Tell me about Mandelstam in Second River.
The fact of the matter was that if I closed the lids over my eyes, I could see the poet, which is what everyone in the camp called him, as clearly as if he was standing in front of me. I could almost reach out and touch him. He was thin like a scarecrow, Excellency, thin and breakable, like the sheets of ice sliding off the roof of the barrack when the sun came out. He refused to collect the bowls of kasha with fat poured over the buckwheat groats handed out twice a day. He was frightened the guards were going to poison him. I scrounged crusts of bread and potato peelings and bone marrow from garbage bins behind the mess barrack, and he ate those, though he didn't have many teeth in his mouth and needed to gum the food. When a convoy of prisoners left for the gulags on Kamchatka, I found an empty top bunk in hut number 11, Mandelstam's barrack, and pretty much became his protector, carrying him piggyback to the latrine and back, carrying him to the infirmary when he complained of stomach cramps or pains in his chest or double vision. In November, Siberian winter blew in from the steppes. When we went to the shower, which was once every 2 weeks, our clothing froze in the damp air of the bathhouse, our trousers leaned up against the wall as if somebody was in them, and Mandelstam would clap his hands and do a jig to fight off the numbness in his feet. His yellow leather coat was in shreds and he took to shivering all the time. I wrapped one of his spare shirts around his neck like a scarf, but it didn't help. One day a prisoner named Archangelsky, he was a real criminal, not an Article 58er like us, asked Mandelstam to read to the criminals that lived in the attic space under the barrack roof. The invitation raised Osip Emilievich's spirits. He combed his hair with his fingers and ironed the rags on his body with his palms. I helped him up the ladder to the loft, which was heated by a wood stove and lit by a paraffin lamp.
The yellow light turned his yellow skin yellower. I lifted Mandelstam, who was getting thinner and weaker with each passing day, onto a high stool, and he began reading from the small book he carried in his pocket wherever he went so it wouldn't get stolen.
Every once in a while he would stare out at the criminals and finish the poem without bothering to look down at the page. He recited other poems written by someone with a name like Voronezh, I think.
The criminals listened with great attention. Sometimes Archangelsky, or another, would ask him to recite the same poem again or say what a certain line or certain word meant. Listening to him along with the criminals, I can't say I understood all that much of what he read, though you could see what Osip Emilievich must have been like when he was young and strong and not sick with fear. Between poems, Archangelsky or one of the others gave him slices from a loaf of bread, or pickled mushrooms from a can, even lumps of sugar from a jar filled with lumps of sugar. Mandelstam wasn't afraid of the criminals. He didn't think they were out to poison him, so he accepted. He wound up reading to the criminals two or three times a week, until... Comrade Stalin leaned forward in his chair. Until? Until spotted typhus struck Second River. The first cases was reported in the middle of December. It spread fast. Anyone with fever was locked in the quarantine barrack. Nobody went in or out. Every morning the infected prisoners emptied slop buckets out the window. Pretty soon word spread that everyone in the barrack was dead. Osip Emilievich begged me not to let them take him to the quarantine barrack. He was shivering so hard I hauled him up to my upper bunk because it was warmer, and covered him with his blanket and mine. When the medical orderlies with masks over their mouths came through in the morning to take off prisoners with fever, I managed to hide Osip Emilievich from them by lying on the bunk alongside him. And then one morning, when it was my turn to fetch the ration of kasha, the other prisoners found him shivering and sweating under his blankets. When I got back, they told me he had a fever. They threatened to report the both of us if I didn't take him off straight away to the quarantine barrack. I bundled him up in the blankets and carried him instead to the camp infirmary. The doctor at the infirmary, an Article 58er like us, stripped Osip Emilievich and washed his body, which was by then only skin and bones, with a sponge and warm water. The doctor combed the lice out of his hair and beard and short hairs and put him to sleep in an army cot with a real straw mattress. I spent as much time with him as I could in the next days. His mind drifted a lot. One time he made me promise to send a telegram to the Writers' Union, informing them he was under the weather and wouldn't be able to read at their auditorium that night. Another time he ranted about having been injected with rabies. Late one afternoon, late in December, I must have nodded off next to his bed. When I woke up, I saw him staring at me with the wide eyes of a child, and I thought to myself, he has made his way back to the safety of childhood before he dies. "Can you hear me, Osip Emilievich?" I whispered. His answer was so soft I had to lean my ear that worked over his mouth to catch it. He said something about how the pinprick of the last star was vanishing without pain. I repeated his words to myself until I had memorized them, though the meaning was a mystery to me. With or without pain, I don't see how a faraway star can give you a pinprick. Then he reached under the rough blanket and began to play with his sex, and I thought to myself, he has made his way past childhood to the safety of babyhood before he dies. I am not ashamed to say I turned my head away so he wouldn't see the tears in my eyes. After a while, I got hold of myself and turned back. Mandelstam was still staring at me with his child's innocent eyes, except they was frozen open and he wasn't breathing. I went into the hallway and gestured to the doctor at the end of it, and he understood and came running and pulled out a pocket mirror and held it to Mandelstam's mouth. And when there was no cloud of life on it, he looked over at me and shook his head. And he said, "Death is not sad when what came before was not life." He printed out Osip Emilievich's name and the date, 27th of December 1938. On a valise tag, and attached it with wire to the poet's big toe. I wrapped his body in a scrap of canvas set aside for that purpose, and carried it to the trench behind the last barrack that was already filled with corpses from the typhus outbreak. A bulldozer was parked nearby, waiting to cover the trench with earth when there was no more room in it. I jumped into the trench and lifted Osip Emilievich down after me, and set him on the frozen ground and, opening the folds of the canvas, I put two small flat stones, the kind you skim off water, on his eyes, which is what you do when you bury a notable in Azerbaijan. And I thought, Jesus, somebody ought to say a prayer or something, what with him being dead. So I said, God of the Jewish, don't assign too much weight to the charges against the poet Mandelstam. It's not his fault he wasn't socially useful. When Archangelsky saw me that night, he wanted to know if the poet was well enough to come up and read to the criminals. I said, no, he wasn't well enough to read. The fact was he would never read again. He was dead. When I finished describing Mandelstam's death, I could hear Comrade Stalin breathing through his nostrils. He was holding the cigarette, but not smoking it. He pulled another telegram from the pile on his desk and said, the camp commandant listed the cause of death as typhus. I must have shrugged because Comrade Stalin burst out, it was typhus, wasn't it? I am not a medical person, Excellency. Who can say why a person dies? In Osip Emilievich's case, he could have died from hunger, since he was afraid to eat his ration. He could have died from not sleeping, since he spent the night tossing and shivering in his bunk. At Second River, prisoners sometimes upped and died when they lost hope. Mandelstam himself said that a few days before he passed on. So Mandelstam is really dead, Comrade Stalin said. You're positive he was the one you buried? I nodded yes. Comrade Stalin ground out his cigarette in an ashtray, even though it wasn't smoked down to the end. In Colmar, at Two Rivers, prisoners would kill for a half-smoked cigarette. Climbing to his feet, he turned to stare out the window. I could make out the lights coming on in the gum office arcades across Red Square. When Comrade Stalin spoke again, I could see he was furious. If the asshole had given me the poem when I wanted it, none of this would have happened. But fuck him! He killed himself with his stubborn-headedness. I had nothing to do with it. And then the Tsar of Soviet Russia did something that scared the bejesus out of me. He began to knock his fist against the glass pane of the window, lightly at first, then harder and harder, and I was sure the glass would break until I figured out it must be as thick as the glass in the Packard. And he shouted out in a voice I didn't recognize, "The prick! What will I do now?" Vlasic started across the room, but Comrade Stalin, his forehead against the window pane, waved him off. I felt the bodyguard's grip on my arm, the one with the almost completely faded face of Stalin tattooed on it. I followed Vlasic through the waiting room and down the hallway. Turning on me, he warned, "Don't tell a living soul what you saw in there." "Comrade Stalin is a great hero to me," I said. "I didn't see nothing out of the ordinary." Vlasic kicked open the door to a toilet. There was a carton on the floor. In it was the canvas trousers and the flannel shirt that had belonged to Magda's suicided husband, and my felt boots with the worn-down cork soles. "The suit and the shirt and the shoes the tailor gave you were on loan," he said. I wasn't sorry to have my own clothes back. Something told me that Agrippina, who I was planning to look up, wouldn't think the tailor-made suit with the double breast jacket suited me.
Chapter 21. Anna Andreevna, Friday, the 4th of June, 1965. No, I don't think I can do this again, even as a favor to Nadezhda. Not now, not ever. Nowadays, when I summon memories of Osip Mandelstam, a certain amount of sheer pain comes up with them. And, frankly, I've had enough pain to last a lifetime. My first husband's execution, my third husband's arrest and death in the gulag, my son's rotting in prison for years a hostage to my good behavior. When the American poet Frost, old red-faced, gray-haired, visited me in 1962, the authorities insisted we meet in one of the plusher dachas in Komarova rather than my modest cottage. I suppose they didn't want him to see into what dirt they'd trampled me. I told him I'd had it all. Poverty, prison lines, fear, poems remembered only by heart, burned poems, and humiliation and grief. Endless humiliation, endless grief. Frost was a kind-hearted gentleman. He meant no harm. But when I realized he expected me to talk about Orsip, the words spilled through my lips before the lobe of my brain that deals with language could formulate a sentence. What I heard myself say was, "You don't know anything about this. You wouldn't be able to understand if I told you." Russia, the running riot we know and loathe and love and fear, is reserved for Russians. It's really not very complicated. My body is here in England to accept this honorary doctorate from Oxford, but my head, my heart, my soul, my gut are back in Russia. Even if by some miracle we get our bodies out, we Russians can't leave Russia. And good-hearted people like Frost can't get in simply because their passport bears a Soviet visa stamp. You have to have lived through the 30s to understand, and even then you don't understand. If you think about it, you'll see I've told you everything I know about dear, dear Orsip, and what was surely one of the most dreadful chapters in Russia's thousand-year history.
Epilogue. Robert Littell, Sunday the 23rd of December 1979. I found Madame Mandelstam as soon as I reached Moscow. Some years before, having led a nomadic existence for decades, she had been granted a residence permit and installed herself in the capital. She invited my companion and me to come by for tea. With the biggest box of chocolates I could find in the hotel's hard currency store under my arm, I flagged down a taxi. It took us to a bleak apartment house in a distant suburb filled with six-story brick buildings that looked as if they had come into existence ramshackled and gone downhill from there. When the door to the ground floor flat opened, we found ourselves standing before a short, worn, emaciated woman, ancient when she should have been merely old. Young poets were taking turns caring for the widow of the poet Mandelstam. One was preparing tea and cakes in the tiny kitchen when we arrived. Madame Mandelstam lay propped up on a settee most of the time we were there, occasionally selecting, after some deliberation, a bonbon from the box of chocolates open on her lap. "I was never skilled at predicting how something would taste from its shape," she said absently. The narrow apartment was terribly overheated. She was wearing a white, sleeveless shift. Her elbows were bare and jutting, the skin on her arms hanging in soft pleats off her bones. The conversation was in English, which she spoke fluently. She had used it to make ends meet with translation work in the years when the poet Mandelstam was not being published and earning no income. When I began recording the conversation, she said, "It's been an eternity since you came around with the infernal taping machine of yours that filled a small suitcase. The time you interviewed Mandelstam, I seem to remember you had to change reels every half hour. After you left, he complained that watching the spools go round made him dizzy. Now you turn up with a device not much bigger than a pack of cigarettes." "In the future, they'll get even smaller," I said. Smiling faintly, Madame Mandelstam looked away. When I was permitted to see him in the Lubyanka, Mandelstam asked me if the future was behind or ahead of us. "What did you answer?" "Damn it, Robert. I can't be expected to remember something I said in 1934. That's why you record these conversations. You tell me what I said." "A lot of water has flowed under the bridge since then," I remarked. "I'll have to look it up in my notes." She laughed under her breath. "My great friend Akhmatova pretended that what flows under bridges is spilt milk. She was surely right. When she died, not long after returning from Oxford, I thought it entirely possible she might have drowned in spilt milk." Responding to a question, Madame Mandelstam began to talk about her husband. "He was a silly young man, very gay even when things started to become difficult for him as a poet in the 20s. He was endlessly zhizneradostny, which can be translated as joyous, or better still, life-glad. In the 30s, when we were especially miserable, we experienced hunger, homelessness, fear,
filth, abject poverty. Mandelstam would ask me, "Where is it written you should be happy?" Staring off into space, Madame Mandelstam seemed to pick up the thread of a conversation with her husband that had been interrupted 41 years before. "I was never disillusioned, my darling, because I never had the luxury of illusions." We sipped our tea. My tape machine recorded minutes of silence. After a while, I asked Madame Mandelstam if she thought her husband had actually come face to face with Stalin. Mandelstam wasn't the only Russian intellectual of his day to be fascinated by Stalin. He wondered what enigmas lay behind those eyes. He was curious about what had transformed the Caucasian peasant Djugashvili into the Kremlin peasant slayer Stalin, which is to say, into a practicing paranoid. "But you haven't answered my question." She thought about this for a moment before coming up with a response that satisfied her. "Mandelstam certainly encountered Stalin," she said carefully. "You must decide for yourself whether the meetings took place in the Kremlin or a dacha or in the poet's head." Responding to another question, she said she had no idea why she hadn't been arrested along with her husband. At both of his arrests, they could have taken her off as easily as they took him. "After the second arrest, I followed Pushkin's advice. Try to be forgotten. I worked at so many jobs and in so many places I've lost track. I was a teacher, a translator. I once cleaned government buildings. I never lived in any one city for very long. I heard there were arrest warrants issued for me, but I kept moving and managed to stay one jump ahead of the Czechists. I had to, if Mandelstam's oeuvre, a portion of which existed and still exists only in my head, was to survive. In the end, obliging you to memorize his poems saved your life." "You are mistaken if you think he obliged me, Robert. I committed his poems to memory because I wanted them on the tip of my tongue. Only later did it occur to either of us that memorizing his oeuvre would give me an incentive to survive if something were to happen to him." Madame Mandelstam closed her eyes for a moment. "Well, against all the odds, I did survive. And here I am back in Moscow, if you can call this Moscow." She waved tiredly at the window, looking out onto another apartment building in her remote suburb. "I'm an old lady now. They have lost interest in me." I asked her to describe the last months before Mandelstam's second arrest. "You must understand, he was never the same after his first arrest. He once told me how, at his very first interrogation, Kristoforovich promised he would experience fear in full measure, and he did. Something happened to Mandelstam in the Lubyanka that crippled his life gladness. On several occasions he let slip allusions to his execution, but he never offered particulars, and I didn't ask, for fear of opening the wound. In exile, even after exile, there were months on end when Mandelstam seemed frightened of his shadow. He was afraid to be left alone. He was afraid to eat unless it was me who prepared the food for him, or he could join others serving themselves from a common bowl. He lay awake nights in Voronezh, later in Kalinin, straining to catch the sound of automobiles braking to a stop, or footsteps drawing nearer on the street, or doors opening in our building. Like countless millions of Russians, he finally fell asleep at dawn. Looking back, I can see there were long stretches when Mandelstam found refuge from terror in madness. It wasn't what I think of as creative madness, which is what drove him to compose that first Stalin epigram. No, no, it was unadulterated madness, filled with auditory hallucinations and demons capable of pushing someone to leap into the darkness from the second story of a hospital. There were also intervals when he would claw his way back to something resembling sanity. It was during these saner moments that he composed the wonderfully wistful poems in his Voronezh cycle. "In splendid poverty, luxurious beggardom, I live alone, both peaceful and resigned." Madame Mandelstam shook her head as if to clear it. It was during a saner moment that he got off a last letter, written on pages torn from his copy of Pushkin, asking me to send warm clothes and soap to him at Votoraya Rechka, which you call Second River. We learned of Mandelstam's death from his brother Alexander. He received an official government letter informing him that Mandelstam died of heart failure on the 27th of December 1938. In those days, everyone who died, whether in the Lubyanka cellars, on the cattle cars heading east, or in the Gulag camps, was said by the authorities to have died of heart failure. So, of course, we considered the official version worthless, except, perhaps, for the date. Akhmatova arrived from Leningrad soon after. I didn't know how to tell her the news without breaking down before I could finish the sentence. So I said, "I am the widow of the poet Mandelstam." And we fell into each other's arms and sobbed until we had used up a lifetime's ration of tears. I mentioned that I was familiar with the poet's last letter and asked her what she made of the signature. "You are not the first to be intrigued by Mandelstam's still dancing, Robert. One could tease various meanings out of the still before dancing. On one level he was surely signalling, with typical Mandelstam bravura, that despite everything he was continuing to dance. A nod to your roaring twenties, when he used to post lookouts at the door so we wouldn't be denounced for doing the Charleston. But my guess is that Mandelstam, as usual, was being more precise. With the cattle car approaching Siberia, he was, like the stars in Philip Sidney's astonishing poem, dancing in place to keep his feet from freezing, against the day when he could make his way back to his best friend and comrade-in-arms and lawful wedded wife. So, still dancing suggests hope. More like hope against hope, but hope all the same. Absolutely. I told Madame Mandelstam how much I admired the two books she'd written that had been smuggled out of Russia and published in the West under the titles Hope Against Hope and Hope Abandoned. How, like a great many people, I thought they were the best writing to come out of Russia, Solzhenitsyn notwithstanding, about the savage Stalinist period that took the lives of millions, the poet Mandelstam among them. I asked if she thought things had changed for the better. She said she hoped against hope this was the case, but you could never be sure. That, like the Jew sitting on the last bench of the synagogue during the time of the pogroms, you had to keep glancing over your shoulder while you prayed if you wanted to survive. When I thought we'd worn out our welcome, I thanked Madame Mandelstam for receiving us. With an effort she rose to her feet and accompanied us to the door. Before opening it to the dark corridor, she said something that has haunted me since. "Don't speak English in the hallway." This concludes the Stalin Epigram. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.